everybody. Let's have an AA meeting. My name's Tim, and I'm an alcoholic. Welcome to the Monday Night Blue Chip Speakers Meeting at the NABA Club, where a member of Alcoholics Anonymous with 1 year or more of sobriety tells his or her story. Each individual in our personal stories describes in their own language and from their own point of view the way they establish their relationship with God. These give a fair cross-section of our membership and a clear-cut idea of what has actually happened in their lives. We hope no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women in our room tonight and listening later on aabluechipspeakers.org, desperately in need, will hear our speaker. And we believe it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I am one of them too. I must have this thing. Richard L. of the 7:30 early morning study group here at NABA has shared with us before from the podium. He's got a little more time, a little more wisdom, I hope. He had plenty of wisdom then. He knocked the ball out of the park. He recently had two new additions to the family. I hope he tells us a little about that. At least he didn't have to drink about it. Richard, please come up.
My name is Richard, and I am an alcoholic. Hey, I wasn't nervous till about a half hour ago, and then I got nervous. What was it like? Well, I grew up in Flint, Michigan, and I had my first drink at the age of 9. I was at my uncle's house for Christmas, and he called it Red Pop, and it was slow gin and 7-Up. And I remember throwing up all that red stuff all over my nice white little suit shirt. But I was the fourth child in a family. I have an oldest brother, two girls, and then me. My oldest brother graduated from high school in 1969. And I think by the time I got through that, my parents were just so happy that I could do pretty much whatever I wanted to. And my two sisters were actually my mother's, too. And they'd let me get away with just about everything if I begged them hard enough. And one of those things I remember, I was 14 years old, and I wanted to drive my friend home to, across the neighborhood, and I talked him into letting me borrow my parents' car. They were out of town for the weekend. But my parents always came home early, and I didn't figure that out. And I came around the corner sideways, and if I did it just right, I could spin the tires and hit the driveway, and I'd pull right in, except for my dad's truck was sitting there. And I thought, uh-oh, I'm in trouble now. But it wasn't bad. You know, I grew up pretty easy. And but my drinking, it was always there and always persistent. And I think about in high school, we would sneak off and we got away with a lot of things in high school. We'd smoke pot. And there's drugs in my story, too. It's really, you know, anything. And I remember coming to NABA in the beginning and somebody would say something about drugs, and in one of the meetings, I forget which one it was, and they'd say, no, we're, you know, this is AA, we'd talk about alcohol. And it's like, well, shoot, I got to go to AA, I got to go to CA, I got to go to NA, I got to go to LA. You know, what am I going to do? I'm going to go to all these places. And so I walked out after about a week of being sober, and I asked this guy, I said, what are you? He said, well, you know, I'm tri-addicted. And I thought, well, I know what dual addiction is, but what's tri-addicted? He said, well, I tried it and I was addicted. And I said, all right, I'm in the right place. So I stayed here and I got connected with the 7:30 group, which still kind of baffles me. You know, most meetings start on the top of the hour, you know, in business and churches and things like that. But here at NABA, there's one at 7:30, there's one at 5:45. I don't know, I guess they just mix it up, make sure we can stay, you know, keep track of what's going on. But then as I got into high school, we started drinking and doing other things. And I remember about 15, I got a fake ID from a guy who got it from another guy, who got it from another guy, who got it from another guy. And back then, we could drink at 18. And I made it I figured 15, if you could drink at 18, you might as well start at 15. And we'd start going to the bars. And I remember that when I turned 18, I went in there for my free drink, and they're like, free drink? You've been coming here for 3 years. So, and it's like they didn't give it to me. And then they let us. We could write our own excuses when we went to school. So you know, I'd write, go into the office and say I'm sick. Please excuse me, I'm sick. And little did I know I really was sick. But I made it through high school barely. And a friend of mine died in a drunk driving accident a year after high school. And he was in the hospital. He survived for 3 days when he was brain dead. And he had two male nurses that took care of him. And they said, you know, what are you going to do with your life? And I said, I don't know. They said, why don't you become a nurse? And I thought, well, that sounds like a pretty good idea. I think I'll do that. They were both male nurses. And they said, you can travel the country. You can get a job just about anywhere. So I said, all right, I'll do that. So I went to school and started going to school. And that's when I quit drinking. I knew that I had to do something if I was going to be able to make it through college. And I went back to interview at the school of nursing. And the dean of the nursing school sat in there, and I had my brand new suit. And I don't know if you know this. Back then, I didn't know this, but they sew the pockets shut in suits. And I thought, a $300 suit, why wouldn't they put pockets in it? And so my friend said, well, you have to cut that little string in there, Richard, and then the pocket opens up. So I finally figured that out. But I go to the dean, and the dean's looking at my transcript, and he said, Richard, he says, you had a lot of fun in high school. And I thought, how can this guy tell? You know, he's brilliant. I mean, he's just, I can't believe he knows. I said, well, yeah. I said, how can you tell? He said, because you sure the hell didn't study. I said, well, yeah, you're right about that. He said, but this one's really got me baffled. He said, how did you get a D- in gym class? And I said, well, I probably would have got an E, but I was a captain of the football team. So, and that's how I got, I thought, I made it just enough to get by. And that was the story of my life. I'd make it just enough. And when I got out of nursing school, I remember the night of graduation, the parts of, that I remember. I went to school in Fort Lauderdale, and this girl lived on the golf course. And we went to her house after graduation. We went out to the bars first, and I got really drunk into a blackout. The thing I remember is they had this really thick carpeting. I don't know if it was thicker if I just couldn't walk. And I'd step on it, and it felt like I was sinking down. And it's probably my knees giving out now that I think about it. But she gave me a cup of coffee, and it was in a glass, you know, those glass cups. And I grabbed it, and I remember it was so hot, I just dropped it on this beautiful white carpeting. She never invited me back to that house either. But I woke up the next day, and there's these stuffed animals up on the ceiling, you know, one of those bedroom shelves. And I thought, oh, shoot, where am I? You know, I didn't have a clue. And I ended up at another girl's house in her son's bedroom. And I thought, whew, that was a rough one. But I started, you know, I kept on drinking and, you know, just kept on going. And, what happened, you know, there's a couple of things that I think about when I was drinking. And one of them, I ran out of gas coming up 400. And it's one that scares me to this day, that one of those that I shouldn't be here stories. And I pulled off the road, and being the good drunk, I wanted to be all the way off the road. So I pulled all the way off into the grass, got in the back of a little Mazda hatchback, and went up to a bar called Cheers. I don't know if anybody remembers that bar up in Roswell. Ended up there and called my wife, my ex-wife, now to come pick me up. But the next day when I went back to get my car, I'd driven over a culvert, one of these big culverts that, on the side of the interstate. And half my tires were off the cement, you know, driving down the road. It was about halfway off. And when I looked over, there's about a 30-foot drop-off into a culvert. So I was literally inches from dropping off into that. And another time, I don't know why I thought this was a good idea, but whenever I'd get pulled over when I was drunk, I'd tell the cops that I'm a nurse, and if you ever get shot, I might be taking care of you. I'm sure that was real reassuring. Especially when I blew the .26 with a cold beer in my hand. But he said, I'll tell you what. I said, are you throwing me in jail for a DUI? He says, no. And I came back, are you throwing me in jail for a DUI? I said, no, but if you keep on talking, I'm going to. He said, what I want you to do is follow me to the next county. I had an outstanding ticket in the next county, .26. And so I closed one eye, got behind the cop car. And I happened to work in the jail part-time. I'd give out medicines to the inmates and stuff. And I remember walking in there and going, does he have to blow? I said, no blow here. And I woke up a couple hours later not knowing where I was. And this, I don't know if you ever drool when you're drinking. you know, like that really nasty drool. And I woke up and my whole side of the face was stuck to the cement cot. And it's like, where am I? You know, another one of those, how the hell did I get here? And I remember coming out of there, and this big guy, and they're trying to do my fingerprints and stuff. This big guy, and I was messing with him, and it's like, no, I work here. I work here. You don't understand. I work here. And they're like, you don't work here. You're drunk. So he threw me back in the cell, and he said, you're not leaving, because I was messing with the people doing my fingerprints. He said, you're not leaving until I leave in the morning. It's like, oh, shoot, I messed up. So I went back. They came back and got me another hour later. He said, are you ready to cooperate? I said, yes, sir, I'll cooperate. So they let me out of jail, and that was a $100 fine for an outstanding ticket. And then another time, I did that three times. I told the cops that if they ever got shot, I'd be taking care of them, but they threw me in jail for DUI. But I don't have to do that today, and that's the beauty of it. So what happened, the State Board of Nursing and the Attorney General of the state of Georgia doesn't think it's a good idea to practice nursing drinking and doing other things. They kind of frown upon that. When you can't pass a urine drug test with your own urine, you can pass it with other people. You know, the nerve of them. You know, it's like, imagine that. So during that time, I was thinking that I'm going to, you know, that's not fair. You know, I should be able to drink. You know, that's not fair. So I thought that I'd do something. I was going to give up nursing so I could continue to drink. And I thought really about 2 weeks about that. And in the meantime, you have to go, if you're in that nursing program, you have to go to a peer support group. So you have to call around and find a group that will come in and let you into their program. And I called about three or four different, you know, Ridgeview, Talbot, Peachford, you know, those types of places. And I had this lady call me back from her hospital bed. And at this point, I'm starting to get nervous. My wife's going, what are you going to do? What are you going to do? Where are you going to work? You know, you're going to lose your job. You know, those types of pressures were coming in. I'd already lost five nursing jobs. I didn't get fired. I resigned right before they fired me. So, but, you know, I thought, and I'll tell you more about that part of it. So I thought, you know, I guess, this lady called me, and I thought, God, she called me from her after back surgery. You know, what type of person does that for somebody else? You know, and I thought, well, it really touched me. It really set a precedent for me as to what Alcoholics Anonymous is really all about. So I came in, and I didn't go into treatment. I refused to do that route because about a year before I got caught through the nursing program, I went to jail for not paying child support with that ex-wife that I told you about. That they want you to pay on time, too. It's, you know, crazy. So, but I went to jail, and this, I think this is the beginning of the end. I went to jail, and I knew I'd been drinking a little bit too much, you know, maybe sometimes in the morning, maybe, you know, on the weekends, you know, I'd cook breakfast with mimosas and shots of Jägermeister, and I thought, you know, a lot of people do that, don't they? You know, but my wife didn't think so. She didn't do that either. But I went to jail, and I didn't go into DTs. And I knew what DTs were because I worked at Grady. And there's a lot of DT, you know, a lot of people, that's one of the fun things about being a nurse at Grady is going in Sunday mornings to the emergency room, turning on all the lights, and you hear this clanging because everybody handcuffed to the stretchers, and I thought that was kind of cool. I never got handcuffed to the stretcher, so I couldn't have been an alcoholic. And then I didn't go into DTs, so I couldn't have been an alcoholic. So that's when I really started drinking. And then, you know, I knew that drugs weren't a real good thing to do. You know, in nursing, if you're taking them from the Pyxis, and they keep track of that stuff, and they want to know why your patient's gotten five times more than the other person's patient, and it kind of puts off red flags. But then, so I started drinking. I thought I better stick with alcohol. It's legal. I can do that, and you know, I'm getting the effect. And then, you know, so I got here, and they said I was on probation for 2 years, and I thought, okay, I can stop drinking for 2 years. I think I can do it. I think I can do it. I'm not sure, but I think I can do it. And when I got here, y'all said all I had to do is just stop drinking for today. And I thought, wow, just for today, that's all I got to do? Yep, don't drink today. Come back tomorrow. Don't drink then. Come back, you know, come back tomorrow. Don't drink today. Come back tomorrow. So I did that, and, you know, that was the start of my journey, you know, the part of what happened. But I wasn't sure I could do that. I didn't know if I could. And then somebody said, well, just don't drink to the next meeting. And So, okay, so there's one at 7:30, there's one at 9, there's one at 11, there's one at 1:30. What am I going to do between 2:30 and 5:45? And, you know, I didn't know what I was going to do because wherever I went, I made sure there's always alcohol that was going to be served there. And then some guys told me that there's a meeting at 4 o'clock at the Triangle. It's like, okay, so I went from here to the Triangle. I live real close, about probably 2 miles away. So I knew I could make it here. There's only one bar that I had to pass by the, from my house to here. No liquor store, so I kind of limited my risk in that first month. And I made it here, and they said at 4 o'clock, you know, there's one at Triangle. So I made it there, then I make it back to 5:45. And I did that for, but I was going through the shakes, the sweats, and the paranoia. And the really thing that I think that really I crack up about is that I'd go to these meetings, and the same people were at these meetings. And I know they're watching me. I mean, they're like, why are you following me? Kind of paranoia. And I figured it out. They're getting sober too. And it's like, wow, y'all are doing this too. You're here every day, just like they told me to come back tomorrow, and y'all came back too. But it was, you know, but that paranoia from drinking so much and detox, and so I don't recommend coming straight. You know, if you have an opportunity to go into treatment, by all means, take that opportunity. So I made it to step one. I quit drinking. My life wasn't unmanageable. I could go to Grady, and there's an ATM machine from the credit union on the second floor, and there's an ATM from Wachovia Bank on the ground floor. And if I went to the one to the credit union at 1:45, I could make it down before 2 o'clock and take the same $200 out that I didn't have in the bank to begin with. So I figured I had this managed pretty good. So that unmanageable part, I got this managed. I know how to do this stuff. So, but then I realized with that, you know, not everybody pays $35 for Domino's $5 pizza, you know, when you add the bounce check fee on. And then when they came out, you know, so I figured, well, maybe my life is a little unmanageable. I haven't filed my taxes since 1989, but they never came and got me. So until recently, but I'm working on that too. But about 90 days in, the paranoia went away, and I started feeling better. And I thought, well, you know, maybe I'm not really an alcoholic, you know. I feel okay. I'm going to be all, you know, maybe a couple of drinks here, a couple of drinks here. But I worked on an ambulance, and it got cold. So I got sober in January. It's probably March, April time frame. It got cold, and I put on my winter coat from the ambulance. And I reached in the pocket, and I had my goals for the year. And it said that I'd only drink 3 days a week. And that, I worked 4 days a week. So I figured if I could make it to work, I worked 12 hours, go to work, go home, go to sleep, go back to work. But those 3 days that I was off, I was only going to drink on those 3 days. And that's when I conceded to my innermost self that if I had to set goals when I was going to drink, then I knew that I was probably an alcoholic. And I got to do that and realize to myself that, yeah, that's, you know, drinking is not an option. And it's an option today, but, you know, drinking normally, I should say, is not an option because that's not how I ever drank from, you know, the time I was 15 to the time I was 46 when I got here. You know, I never knew when I was going to end up home. You know, I'd start off for one or two and end up at home at 3 or 4 in the morning. I called in sick one time to Grady, and I went to work. I didn't know I called in sick until I got to work, and they said, you called in sick about 3 hours ago. And it's like, whew, I'm glad I did that. So they said, you better go home. You better leave before the manager gets here and sees you. And he'd take this toothpaste with you, too, because you're going to need that, you know, on the way out the door. So I say that to say this. If I ever was a nurse to any of your family members or loved ones, please accept my apology for not doing my best. You know, you deserve better than that. And I apologize for that. But I got to step two, the insanity. Restore me to sanity. I thought sanity, you had to be crazy. And I knew crazy. I worked at Grady. And Grady, the psych floor is on the 13th floor, really? I mean, you put it on the 13th floor. I mean, it's like, okay. So that insanity. But then somebody told me that if I did the same thing and I expected different results, if I went out to the bar for 2 beers and think that it wasn't going to end up at 4 o'clock in the morning drunk, trying to get home, telling the cops, if you ever get shot, I'll be the one taking care of you, that is the definition of insanity. If you think it's going to be different. And I proved to myself that it wasn't. I tried many a times in many ways to limit my drinking, just to those two beers, but it never worked. So I got step two. I thought, you know, okay, they can restore me to sanity. God can, or a higher power can. But when I got to step three, it's like, I'm going to turn my life and my will over to a higher power. Well, I wasn't real happy with a higher power, with God, as they understood him. He, you know, he let things happen to children. And I thought, you know, how can you have all this power and you let that happen? How, you know, why did that little girl get blown up? You know, couldn't you have blown out the match before they ignited the furnace? And she was standing there. You know, couldn't you stop the guy from, you know, putting a claw hammer through the little kid's head before he got there? And so, you know, I didn't know how to cope with that. Alcohol and drugs. I remember interviewing to work at the Grady Byrne unit, and the nurse recruiter says, well, how do you handle all this stuff? And in my mind, I said, drugs and alcohol, how the hell does anybody handle all this stuff? But I said prayer and meditation. So I knew that there might be something to that. But I said, you know, but that's how I cope with those things, with drugs and alcohol. And I could get, you know, some of the hardened bartenders in town to buy me a drink when they'd see something on the news, and I'd, you know, have those sad eyes when I didn't have no money and I still needed a drink. And they'd say, you know, were you working today, Richard? Yeah, I was working today. I had to do all that stuff. I said, can I have a free drink and a couple shots? It'll be a lot easier. But I didn't know what to do. You know, I didn't know how to cope with that. But then step three, you know, I came to realize that God probably wasn't real happy with me either, you know, with some of the things that I'd done. So I called a truce. I said, God, you okay? I'm okay. I'm okay with you. You're okay with me. So I said, you know, can we just... And then that was the start of a new relationship with a higher power. And it's been, you know, one of those journeys that it's just amazing. And what I did when I was drinking is I would stop to the bad parts that God provided. Or I don't know. But, you know, I just got to that part, and I would use that as an excuse to drink. I never got to see the grace that people get to show and experience when they're going through the tough times. I didn't think we should have to go through tough times, but that's the part that I cut myself off from. I didn't get a chance to see God's grace and when people are going through struggles. And then I got to step four, and this reverted back to my childhood and my sister's. I was here, and I asked 10 different men, how do you do step four? You know, how do you do it? He said, well, you just do it. You just write it down. You just do it. It's like, no, how do you do step four? No, you just do it. And then after I did it, I realized they didn't hear the question I was asking them. The question was, when are you going to do step four for me? But none of them did it. They said, just do it. You just got to do it. So I got to do that, and I got to take that inventory to get all that stuff out that I was going to, you know, that anger that I had against God, that anger that I had against my ex-wife who threw me in jail for not paying child support because it was her fault. If I just would have paid child support, then maybe I wouldn't have went to jail. Oh, wait, I thought, whoa, I thought it was her fault. But now you're saying that if I would have paid the child support first, then they would have never said I was in contempt of court. So it's really my fault that I didn't pay child support. Whoa. And so it was, and yeah, you know, I did it. I didn't write the check. Caught me. So I got to five. And my mother, 2007 was a bad year. My mother passed away. State Board of Nursing said that I couldn't drink and do drugs anymore, and I thought it was a bad year, but it turned out to be, you know, one of those years that changed my life for the better, I do believe. And so step five, I got to do, my sponsor said that I should do it in a spiritual place first, and then that we'd talk about it. So I got to do it on Mother's Day. My wife went to her mother's house, and they said I should do it in a spiritual place, so I came to NAVA in the parking lot. It was the most spiritual place that I knew at the time. And I remember just crying in the back parking lot, overlooking the creek, going through this step five, you know, my step four and step five. And then they said that I should go home and relax, you know, go someplace peaceful just to relax, to bring it all in. And I went home to the back deck, and we had these big pine trees in the back, and the wind was blowing, as you know, going back and forth, and it looked like God was doing this, you know, in my mind, this orchestra for me, just with these pine trees just going swaying back and forth. And I knew that my life had been changed. I don't know how it was going to be changed or what was going to happen, but I knew that it was changed. I couldn't go back to the way, you know, I didn't want to go back, and I just knew it wasn't right to go back, that I needed to keep on moving forward through these steps. And then I got to do it with my sponsor, and, you know, it was really interesting to hear his, you know, the things that he shared with me so I could be more honest and share with him. One thing about honesty, I forgot to tell you all this. The first meeting I went to was at Gwinnett Room. A friend of mine had made an appointment to go to an AA meeting, so she, you know, met me there. And then I went back a week later, and I mean, I was in a fog. I didn't know what was going on. You know, these people are, you know, I didn't know this either, but when you say anybody new and they, you know, less than 90 days, I raised my hand. This is the first time I've ever been to this meeting, and they start talking about a first step meeting. It's like, why are they talking about this honesty stuff and all this first step stuff? And so I went back to that 7 o'clock meeting at the Gwinnett Room, and they asked, you know, does anybody have anything on, you know, the topic that they want to talk about? So I raised my hand, you know. I said, what's this honesty? What's that all about? You know, and the guy looked at me like, whoa, keep on coming back. And, you know, because I was there, I was sober a week, and I didn't have a clue about honesty. I'd lied so much, and, you know, I lied and lied and lied. I remember lying to my ex-wife. I went to Panama City, and I told her I was in Athens hunting. And I didn't make it home for a couple of days. And it's because she had all these parking tickets, and I got thrown in jail for 2 days. Why didn't you call? I said, well, I didn't want to bother you, honey. I just didn't want to bother you. I just forgot to get out on Monday morning. But she caught me about 6 months later when I was talking about being in jail, you know, with the cops that throw me in jail. So I told her about I said something about being in jail 2 times, and she said, wasn't it 3? I said, oh. And that soon after that, it's when I got divorced. I called her up from Miami, and I said, honey, you don't want to be married to me. And she said, you got that right. Click. So I made it to step 6. And, you know, selfish and self-centered, and that was me. You know, that, I think if there's one character defect that I have that stems from, that helps feed all the other ones, is that selfish and self-centered. I didn't care. I'd tell you I'd be there at 1 o'clock. I didn't say it was going to be today. You know, I may show up in 3 days, but, you know, I'll see you at 1 o'clock. And my nickname was No Show. My friends would call me No Show because they didn't know, you're not going to show, you're No Show. So, and I did that so much that I thought it was okay. I didn't think anybody, it bothered anybody that, you know, I'd tell them I'd go help them move, and, you know, they're expecting me to be there and not there. And that affected my family too. You know, when I was divorced with my kids, you know, I'll come over, you know, I'll pick you up at 5 o'clock Friday and, you know, show up Saturday morning. You know, they're packed, their bags are packed waiting for me. And that hurts. Now, you know, then, you know, I just drank more, so it didn't hurt. But, you know, so selfish and self-centered is really one of my glaring defects. And I have, you know, the list of others, too. But I thought, well, how, you know, if I'm selfish and self-centered, what do I do with that? And I heard one time that if I'm grateful to have a car, then give somebody a ride. And that really stuck with me. I can figure, you know, because I heard about these gratitude meetings, and it's like, well, I'm grateful. I'm so happy to be here. But if I'm grateful, how do I show that gratitude? You have to show that gratitude. So if I'm selfish and self-centered, how do I change that? And I was sitting at home one day, and my wife, she always wanted me to go into the bathroom when she's taking a bubble bath. Now, what man in their right mind is going to do that? You know, there's ESPN on. The top 10's coming up, again, for the 5th hour in a row. Why would I go in there and sit on the commode while my wife's taking a bubble bath? And I thought, well, I guess this is the part where if you're selfish and self-centered and they tell you to do something for somebody else, maybe this is the part where I'm supposed to do something for somebody else. And so I went in there and I sat down. And the smile that was on her face, I can see it as if it happened, you know, before I got here today. Just that smile of just in that connection that we had. And I thought, you dumbass, you've been cheating yourself of these moments because it was more important to drink. And I thought, man, if that's what it is to be, you know, to help others or to give, you know, how much I got back from that moment is just stuck with me for, you know, for years that I'm able to, and as literally I was in there for less than a minute. And that's all she wanted, you know, a minute of my time. But I was too busy, and I was too worried about. And one of the reasons why I married her is, well, she only drank half a margarita, so that means I could drink the other half, and she would drive home. I thought, wow, she's a keeper. I'm going to keep this one. So, but you know, I got to meet a lady, and we had a conversation about 6 months ago, and she said, you know, if you ever drink again, I'm going to leave you. I said, and we're just having a conversation. It wasn't a threat. It was just, you know, we're just talking. I said, oh, really, why? She goes, because my grandfather was an alcoholic, my dad's an alcoholic, my stepdads are alcoholics, and I married an alcoholic, but you've shown me that I don't have to live like that anymore. And I thought, what a gift that Alcoholics Anonymous has given to my wife. You know, to be able to have that, knowing that she doesn't have to put up with the BS that I put her through. You know, the throwing things, and, you know, having me, one of my favorite drunk stories is, I was at the bar all day, you know, it opens at 11. I had it timed pretty well. I could just about reach the door handle the same time the bartender was unlocking it. I could get there at 11 o'clock. And so I'd been there, and I was calling around to get stuff so I could drink longer. And I was calling this one guy, but this other guy was on the phone, and he said, your collard greens are ready. And it's like, how did he get on the phone? And so my wife gets there. She ordered something for dinner, and I said, no, we got to leave now. We got to leave right now. So we left Midtown on the way over to Briarcliff, and I made her, there's a white SUV was following us. This is when the drinking was really heavy and the paranoia was kicking in. And there's a white SUV that was following us. And I make her pull into this driveway, stop, you know, turn off the lights, you know, there they go. And and so that's how it got. You know, that's where my bottom took me to. And we got to the library, and there's a white SUV dropping off books there. And I thought, you're in on it. I know you're in on it. And she's like, just shut up. You know, just get home so I can put your ass to bed. And she tells the story that as we pull into the driveway, we're in the flight line for the children's hospital. They could leave from one hospital to go get fuel at PDK. She said she could hear that helicopter coming, and she knew she had to get me in the house before the helicopter got there, or else she didn't know what I was going to do, if I was going to take off running or what. So like any good drunk, you have to return to the scene of the crime. I mean, you just have to go back to the bar the next day to see what really happened. So I get there, and the guy who was on the phone with the collard greens, he said, Richard, what happened to you yesterday? He said, I called you and said your collard greens were ready. He wanted me to cook you some. So I was supposed to go pick up the collard greens that he cooked for me that I'd forgotten about. So that's the collard green story. But so I made it to step seven, and then I had to go to step eight. And I thought, how am I going to write the list down of all the people that I'd harmed? There's so many people, that I didn't know. So I started writing it down, and went over it with my sponsor, and he looked at it. He said, oh, that's good. You know, these are all good. He said, but I don't see, where's the IRS? Didn't you say something about the IRS in step five that you owed, that you hadn't filed your taxes in 20 years? Yeah, but I paid taxes a little bit. Not very much, but I paid some. But I said, yeah, the IRS too. So I started working on the IRS. And they're not bad people. You know, if you talk to them, they'll talk back to you and, you know, tell you what you need to do. And, you know, this is, you know, but they want to know your bank accounts. They want to know where you work. They want to know, you know, where your money's coming from so they can get it. And that's okay today. They can have it. They can, you know, that financial insecurity leaves some days. But I made it to step eight and made that list. And I made it to step nine. And I wanted to make my amends to my father. That was real important to me before he passed away. So I made it, and I went up and made an appointment to talk to my dad. And he's, you know, I apologized for the things that I'd done, you know, the wrecked trucks, the not showing up, the not being there, you know, all those things that I'd done. And he said that, you know, thanks for telling me, but, you know, your life has been a big disappointment. And I thought, wow, that's pretty deep, Dad. But the big difference was, is I didn't say, yeah, but I did this, yeah, but I did that. I didn't say any of those things, and I just let it go at that. You know, that was his opinion, and that's fine. You know, I did my part of that amends. It hurt. Still hurts today, but it's okay today. I can talk to somebody about it when it hurts too bad. You know, I don't have to drink over it. And I didn't have to argue with them anymore. And that was the cool part about it. And then I got to step 10, and step 10 is an interesting one. I always think of this nurse manager that was my manager. And we have these TVs. I worked at the children's hospital, and we have these TVs up above the patient's beds. And she was talking to me about something that I needed to do, and she was the assistant nurse manager, and I was just staring at those TVs like a little kid, not paying attention to her, you know, just totally disrespecting her, not doing anything. And finally she got tired of that, and she went off to the bathroom, and I thought, God, this must be step 10. When I wrong promptly admitted it, I was like, oh, man, really? I got to do that too? So she came back out of the bathroom, and I said, you know, I want to apologize for the way I acted. You know, I really shouldn't have done that. I should have gave you respect in the time of day. I apologize for not doing that. And I get to do step 10 whenever I make a mistake and, you know, look at things, you know, what is my part? You know, that whole what is my part in this? Why did I treat somebody like that? Why was I disrespectful? Why did I yell at my wife, you know, for whatever reason? It's always the silliest reason why I yell at my wife, too. It's nothing big that I can think of. No, nope. Just little things like, why did you do that? Why do I have to go get Chick-fil-A tonight? Why can't you? You know, it's like, really, I got to go, you know, it's that minute again. I have to drive a minute to help her out. So made it through step 9. Most of them, there's still one that I struggle with. I have a son from a paternity suit that I've never seen. And that I struggle with that. You know, do I reach out for him? And it's September, really, it always comes up, you know, step 9. Another thing they do in here, too, like January is about step 1 and step studies or book studies. February step 2, and they do this, like, through the year. And then it took me a couple of years to figure that one out, too. That, you know, so step 9 comes up in September, and I always struggle with this. Do I reach out and try to find him? I've never, you know, I saw him when he was born, and then I saw him when he was 2.5 years old. Or do I just be available in case he reaches out to find me and be willing to do that? And my sponsor keeps on telling me to be willing to do that. To, you know, don't do it selfishly because you want to go, you know, are you going to upset this child's life that you haven't been into for 20-some years? You know, but you're available. He knows how to get a hold of you if he wants to get a hold of you. I'm not hiding anything. So that's, you know, I'm still struggling with that. But then step 11, you know, try to pray and meditate to the best of my ability. And then I make it to step 12, and I try to help. And I remember that lady who called me from her hospital bed. You know, that's, do I want to be like her? Is that what I want? Is that, you know, if I want what she has and I have to do what she does, I have to be available to help out. And I get the chance to go to nursing schools and talk about drug addiction and alcoholism in nursing and substance abuse in nursing. And the first time I did it was really cool. They applauded and complimented me. And don't, you know, that's, for me, that's that ego thing and that selfish thing just blows up when I get compliments. But the second time I have to go down to Noonan. So I'm leaving, have to be there like at 8 o'clock and I'm driving down there and it's, you know, I'm going through all this stuff in my head and it's like, they need to put those cell phones up, turn off the computers, pay attention, I got something important to tell them, and that little voice in your head that comes on, I don't know if anybody else hears this, says, you know, that, look, man, you're going down there to tell them how you lost 5 jobs, got suspended by the Board of Nursing, had your license under, do you really have something to tell these people? And, you know, and so I had to laugh at myself. I'm just going down there to share a story, and if I can help one person, I hope that one person can hear it. And a lady came up to me afterwards. She goes, oh, I'm so glad you came. You know, there's other people in recovery that's in nursing. I said, yeah, there's a lot of us. You know, a lot of us get to make it. But then, you know, so what's it like today? I get to do a lot of service work. And I have a lot of blessings and a lot of things to be grateful for. My wife just had a baby 9 months ago. We went to the hospital pregnant 5 times and we got to bring home one child. And to see that joy on her face, you know, I'm too old to be having babies, but that's okay today. You know, you have more energy when you're not running the bar or staying up late. And so today I asked her, I said, you know, what is there anything you want me to say? You know, what can I share about our relationship? And she said, just tell them that you're present in our relationship. Now, you know, because of Alcoholics Anonymous, I get to be present in her life and my son's life. And then I also get to be present in my granddaughter's life, who's 6 months old. So I have a son that's 9 months old and a granddaughter that's 6 months old. So it's fun. It's a blast, you know. And I get to volunteer at different organizations. I get to be a facilitator for a nurses group that I had to go to. I was there tonight. We meet on Monday night. So if you know any nurses that need to come to a recovery place, we meet at Briarcliff at the Georgia Nurses Association headquarters on Mondays from 5:15 to 6:30. More than welcome anybody. You know, it's a peer support group for nurses who are either on suspension or worried about the substance use in their life. They're more than welcome to come. And I remember that lady that called me. And then I get to volunteer. You know, I work now at the Children's Hospital, and I get to volunteer there as well. And I get to volunteer at a camp called Camp Braveheart for kids with congenital heart disease and heart transplants. We got to take 250 children to camp this year with some type of heart disease, 17 heart transplants. And I got to meet a guy that invited me out to dinner last night that it just blows me away. And he gave me a pen, and it's got two hearts on it. And the first one has a date when he got his first heart transplant. And the second one also has a date when he got his second heart transplant. And he calls me a friend today. And that just is, it's all because of Alcoholics Anonymous. So when I was drinking, and I told you about the grace of God, I would go up to the part to where it stopped, and I'd go get drunk, and I wouldn't see it all the way through. I wouldn't play the tape all the way through. You know, what does God do when things are tough? You know, I ran to the bottle. But now I get to see what that grace is. I get to meet people like Clayton, who gives me a pin that, you know, to celebrate his second heart transplant, drives up from Statesboro and goes to Emory to clinic and calls me to take me out to dinner. And this weekend I get to go to Daytona and to the race. I'm a born again NASCAR fan. And I get to go to a race. I met a homicide detective from the Daytona Beach Police Department. I was taking care of his son, and he invites us down, and he even accepts a couple of my friends that they can come to, who's always entertaining. They like to bicker and get on each other, but they put us in the back of a police car and drive us into the racetrack, and then they let us out. That's the really cool part. But that, and the first time, and there's a gentleman that comes to this club that went to Bristol, Tennessee with us, and the first time when a member from Alcoholics Anonymous gets in the back of a police car, they're like looking around, you sure we're getting in here? Are you sure we're getting out? I think it's a more important question. But to be able to do that, and that, you know, the homicide detective's son passed away, and I get to see the grace that his higher power has brought him through that with his family and the love and the connection. When I was drinking, I never got to see that. You know, they don't show that in the bars. They don't, you know, that happens when you're involved with other people. And when I get to volunteer at camp, I like to leave y'all with this. I call it my contempt prior to investigation story. So I'm at camp. I have 8 10-year-old boys, and the first boy that comes into the cabin says, Mr. Richard, is it wrong to play with yourself all day? I said, it's like, whoa, wait a second. We better go get the camp director before I answer this one. And I thought, well, why do you say that? He says, well, I don't have any friends, and I just sat at home and play all by myself. Thank you.
Thank you, Richard. Boy, do I feel good now. I bet you I'm not going to have to take a drink tonight before bed. And it'll probably, I might be able to get to that next meeting tomorrow. Who's with me? Yeah. Everybody going to be sober tonight?
Yeah.
Awesome.
First I slept and then I crept to a hope-filled dream. You rescued me and finally waking there I see. I look into love's window for a soul that's meant for me. Takes me where the promises are real. Sometimes quickly, sometimes slow, we get just what we need. On a broad highway, stride for stride, we walk eternally. Look into love's window for a heart that beats for me. Takes me where the promises are in. And I always long for something that sets me free. Take me where